Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. In her new book, The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World, Michelle Goldberg shows that at the root of many of the world's most pressing issues, national security, population control, poverty, human rights, religious conflict, is the question of who controls a woman's body. It's a stunning thesis, and it's one that she elucidates brilliantly based on her reporting throughout four continents. She shows that the emancipation of women is a key human rights struggle of the 21st century, perhaps the key human rights struggle of the 21st century. I agree with author Jeff Charlotte, who calls this a landmark book, bold and vital. He writes, "We're lucky that we have Michelle Goldberg, a brilliant and clear-eyed journalist, to bring us news of how the struggle over reproductive rights has gone global." Michelle Goldberg is the author of Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, which was a New York Times bestseller. She's a former senior writer at Salon.com, and her work has appeared in many publications, including Rolling Stone, The New Republic, and The Nation. Her work on the means of reproduction was supported by a 2008 J. Anthony Lucas Work in Progress Award. In conversation with Michelle Goldberg tonight, we're very lucky to have Sue Horton, who is the op-ed and Sunday opinion editor of the Los Angeles Times. She previously served as deputy California editor at the paper and as editor of the Sunday opinion section. Before coming to the Times, she was editor-in-chief at the LA Weekly for 6 years. And Sue is also the author of a nonfiction book, The Billionaire's Boys Club, which was the basis for an NBC miniseries. Please join me in welcoming Sue Horton and Michelle Goldberg to the Loud series. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sue Horton, and that leaves her to be Michelle Goldberg. I did something really stupid several months ago, which was that when Louise called me and asked me to do this interview tonight, I said yes. And the reason that was stupid is that Michelle's book wasn't out then, so I had no idea what I was getting myself into. But happily, it proved to be a very good thing, since I now have read the book and absolutely love it. It's a very ambitious book that also is extremely readable, and that's a hard thing to pull off. So without going any further on that, let's just start hearing from Michelle. The book ranges very widely through all kinds of issues of reproduction around the world, and it starts with the whole issue of overpopulation, which I think today we think of as an environmental issue, as a fairly liberal issue. But it didn't start life that way. It started out as, it had some very conservative origins. And I wonder if, Michelle, you'd talk about that.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I guess I knew a bit about going into the book, but especially once I started digging through the archives, which was one of my favorite things about doing this book, was, you know, going into all these historical archives and playing amateur historians, you know, finding old CIA reports or old, kind of National Security Agency memos. And this was there's a long history of kind of liberal, free-thinking family planning types, but the people who were most concerned about family planning or about overpopulation in the 50s and 60s were almost these kind of Dr. Strangelovian military men or ex-military men or businessmen who believed that overpopulation was going to cause so much misery in the world that it was going to lead to communist revolution in all these countries that felt like they had no other option. And so the way to defeat communism is to, inundate the developing world with contraception, and even more than with contraception, to kind of use all the techniques of Madison Avenue and, you know, the kind of things that you see in Mad Men to convince these countries to change their, you know, fundamental family structures and, you know, to make kind of really big changes in the way of life, in their way of life. One thing I found in the archives at the Population Council was this old Disney movie that was commissioned, you know, that used kind of Disney animation to, and I think was translated into 25 languages, and it shows this happy family, you know, with like a radio and enough food and saying, you know, you too can have this with the miracle of family planning. And then it shows, you know, and then it kind of, all those things disappear and they show more kids, like more kind of scrawny children around a single bowl. And it says, you know, or you can have, you know, or you can have, you know, this kind of immiseration. And so part of the problem, I mean, what's interesting is that although this didn't start out with kind of feminist intentions, it in many cases had quite profound feminist results. But it also meant that because that wasn't the point, you had a lot of these programs early on were not necessarily coercive in like the China sense, but were coercive in that there was a lot of emphasis placed on permanent methods, you know, things that women couldn't reverse, you know, IUDs even in places where women necessarily couldn't go somewhere to have it removed, you know, maybe programs that gave you like a transistor radio or a new sari if you agreed to a vasectomy or a sterilization. And that was why in the 70s and 80s and even in the early 90s, there was a huge feminist movement against population control. And sometimes people would even accuse the feminists of being in bed with the Vatican, which is something that we think of as kind of unthinkable today.
Well, I think that's an interesting point that comes out over and over and over in this book, is that there's that the traditional things of a feminist ideology versus an anti-feminist ideology are, and liberal and conservative, and those things don't have as clear edges in this whole issue. That whereas in the U.S. birth control was really something that gave women much more control of their bodies, it could also be used coercively and was used coercively, and without that same thought behind it and that same sort of
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you kind of have to use these terms, right, to some extent, you know, rather, you have to use terms like, you know, feminist and anti-feminist and liberal and conservative at certain points, you know, as kind of shorthand, otherwise you'll be lost in this kind of, you know, thicket of words all the time. But yes, it's certainly true that the lines are constantly blurring and shifting, and, you know, is it like conservative or liberal when someone like Alexander Haig supports supports kind of the mass diffusion of contraception, or when, you know, George H.W. Bush chairs a conference on population in Budapest and tries to convince the entire world that they need to provide more access to family planning.
Actually, that brings up my absolute favorite little tidbit in the book, which is George H.W. Bush's nickname in Congress was
Rubbers. Yeah. Because he was so obsessed with population control and contraception, you know, which was a position that he very quickly abandoned once he joined the Reagan ticket.
and some of the governmental attempts to control population were really quite coercive. Can you talk a little bit more about those?
Yes, and the ones that our government undertook were not really the worst, although we were certainly involved in some coercive programs, particularly in Latin America. And we were also, the USAID, which was the main agent of kind of population programs, was also involved in, for example, at one point, they had procured a bunch of Dicon Shield IUDs, which were later shown to be incredibly dangerous. There was a recall, but you know, the recall certainly didn't reach all of the women who had already had them inserted, and it didn't even reach, you know, the kind of clinics that these things had been distributed to. Now, on the one hand, USAID didn't know when they bought these Dicon shields, but they also were so kind of concerned with, you know, quantity over quality. They had such a kind of utilitarian view of the whole thing, you know, so if you have to cut corners here or there, there was a sense that you were doing it for the greater good, and they had this real sense of kind of mission, you know, about it. then again, there was these kind of reward programs, which at the time people didn't question too much. Today would be, most people would consider that kind of outrageous, giving someone a transistor radio in exchange for a vasectomy. The real coercive programs, though, were in India, obviously, during the emergency, which was, again, this kind of idea that overpopulation was going to cause, like, widespread disaster, that it was the biggest threat facing the planet, is a little bit hard to even appreciate today, how widespread and kind of popular that was. And it was very much believed by the Indian leadership, and it was especially believed by Indira Gandhi's son, who, spearheaded all of this, set up these kind of, horrible vaccination camps, was, just rounding up men and shipping them there, some of whom had never had children, some of whom had already had vasectomies, they kind of had these tyrannical quotas that were coming down from the top. And then, obviously, the other big example of that was China. And the irony about China is that for a long time, China insisted that there was no problem with overpopulation, and that, the United States and kind of the Western countries were trying to convince the third world and that overpopulation was a threat to their futures. And countries like China, Brazil, and some other countries were saying, no, the real problem is an unjust economic system. And they also believed that the United States was kind of trying to, diminish their power, or kind of weaken them by diminishing their numbers. And then you had this total switch where the Chinese decided, no, overpopulation is a huge threat, and we're going to adopt, this kind of draconian one-child policy, which, with it came, forced abortions, forced sterilization, mandatory contraception, this kind of totalitarian system of surveillance of women's reproductive life. And then at the same time, the United States essentially took, the mirror image of the old China line, which was the problem isn't too many people, it's a bad economic system. Although in Reagan's case, the bad economic system was, the world's failure to adopt laissez-faire capitalism.
That brings up an interesting point about China and also in India, where there were really intense attempts to control the population, that one of the unintended consequences of that was the great desire to have boys that led to there's also, throughout the book, I think, that you do a very good job of showing how technology was just slightly ahead of sort of our ethics of dealing with that technology. And one of the things that came along, of course, was the ability to tell definitively the sex of a fetus.
Right, and in China, just this week, there was a new report that that there's currently 32 million more boys than girls in China, which is going to have huge repercussions in the future. I quote some scholars in that book who've done research on societies in the past that had big sex ratio imbalances. In the past, it was usually due to both infanticide and the fact that in certain countries during famines and things, boys would get fed before girls. But anyway, these researchers have found, there's a really direct correlation between sex ratio imbalances and, aggression, expansion, all these kind of unmarried men, undomesticated men need somewhere to direct their energy. And I think it's going to be a real problem in India and also in China. In China and also in India. And in a way, India is even a little bit more confounding as a problem, because in China it's pretty obvious where this is coming from. You have a one-child policy, you have a culture that has traditionally been very patriarchal and focused on sons. There was a history of female infanticide that was then, there was progress, things were made a lot better. But then this gave people the chance or the opportunity to kind of do that without it taking the same kind of human toll and the same kind of moral costs. It's one thing to having an abortion is not the same as killing a child, which no matter how much of a kind of patriarch you are, is never an easy or kind of cavalier thing to do. And in China, kind of as you would expect, it's the countryside that that has, the highest sex ratio imbalances. Kind of urban, modern people are, less desperate for sons. What's interesting is that in India, it's much less clear cut, right? First of all, you don't have the same coercion. You know, you do have this many multi-decade program of trying to convince people to have smaller families.
And there's the Punjabi saying that you have in the book about raising a daughter is like watering your neighbor's garden, which is...
Well, yeah, you have these kind of out-of-control dowries where, you know, especially in the North, but one of the effects of kind of globalization in the media is that richer people in the South imitate some of the customs of... I mean, poorer people in the South imitate some of the customs of richer people in the North, including these kind of outsized dowry demands, which have gotten worse with technology. You know, I think one person says to me that the average dowry has to have, you know, a television, a washing machine, a motorcycle, or, you know, a car if you're a landowner, or a refrigerator, gold, all these things. You know, it's this huge outlay of money that you're, and it can go on throughout your child's married life. It's not like you just pay once. You know, you're kind of expected to pay this constant kind of tribute to the groom's family in order to, and with, you know, kind of terrible consequences for the girl if that doesn't happen. But one result of that is that, you know, it's not the poorest people who are the most desperate for sons. In many cases, it's like the richer people that have more to lose.
Why don't you tell the story of the two women who were married to the man who...
Oh, yeah, this is a horrible story, and you know, I kind of contrast it because there's two images or two sides to who's having sex selective abortions. On the one hand, there's, you know, kind of rich, you know, very well off, well educated people in Delhi's, you know, kind of upper class suburbs, but there also is places where there's real coercion, you know, and where women are absolutely desperate to have boys, and so there's. In Gujarat, in the capital of Gujarat, Ahmedabad, I met a woman at a shelter named Sunita who had been married, I think, when she was a teenager to an Ayurvedic medicine salesman. She got pregnant. She had a daughter. She got pregnant again. She had another daughter. When she was pregnant for the third time, he took her for an ultrasound. And when it was, and meanwhile, once her, you know, inability to have a son, and of course, it's the sperm that determines the sex of the child. But there's obviously, you know, no telling these guys that. So he's beating her terribly. He takes her finally to have an ultrasound. It's a girl. He makes her have an abortion. And I mean, these are all second trimester abortions because you can't tell with an ultrasound until the second trimester. She has four more abortions, one after the other. She keeps getting pregnant. He keeps making her have abortions. He takes another wife, which is not, you know, kind of within the Hindu tradition, but he does it anyway. She's the other wife. At first, she's living with a relative. At first, she's living with his relatives, but then she gets pregnant. He brings her to his home. He's treating her actually quite well until it turns out that she's pregnant with a girl as well. He makes her have, he makes her have two or three abortions. The torture of these two women gets worse and worse and worse and worse until he is, you know, driving nails into their ears. I mean, he's just an absolute sadist. And this was a case that made news in that region and that, you know, people paid a lot of attention to. Finally, the two women together ran away. And they found a rickshaw driver who luckily he picks up these two kind of sobbing women who have no idea where they're going. And he takes them to this shelter. And the woman at the shelter told me, you know, she had never seen anything like this before. The news gets around, and one interesting thing was that as the news got around and it was reported, especially in some of the local women's magazines, a couple other women ran away from their terrible situations because it was the first time they had ever heard of there being a place where you could go. You know, that's one of the things that the woman who ran the shelter mentioned to me, is that in the past, your only option was to kill yourself. You know, the very fact that they ran away is a small, small, small sign of change, but, you know, a very kind of not much of a consolation. And then eventually the younger wife, Kajal, two things happened. The older wife was pregnant when she ran away. And as, you know, this kind of, you know, some of the things in life that you can't really make up, she ends up having a boy. The husband is now desperate to get her back, but he had been, you know, imprisoned for abuse, for beating them. He had, you know, been arrested. This whole thing had made news. And then eventually he starts wooing Kajal, the younger wife, who, telling her that, you know, you'll be the first wife, you'll have the house. And eventually these women have nowhere to go. They have no education. They, you know, the idea of living in a shelter for the rest of their lives is humiliating to them. They feel completely lost. And so the younger wife went back to him. And the older woman, the older wife, older being relative, these are both very young women, but Sunita kept saying to me that she feels like her only hope, the only thing that's ever going to give her identity, that's going to give her anything to cling to, is when this boy of hers grows up.
Wow. Since we're on a really horrible, gruesome topic, let's stay on one and talk a little bit about genital mutilation. You, I would say, come down very strongly on against female circumcision as the horror that it is. But there are women in parts of the world, and women you talk to during the course of your research, who defend the custom and say that it's a cultural bias to be opposed to it.
Right, and not necessarily the woman that you would expect who defend it. And let me just tell you quickly what that's doing in the book. I mean, what I'm trying to do in this book, in many cases, is to show the connection between these like abstract global politics of UN conferences and international law and all this, global policy making, and then to take that down to the ground and show how that actually can change women's lives. And one of the places you can see that the most strongly is with female genital mutilation, where there was this real campaign to eradicate it worldwide. And although it hasn't eradicated it, it has resulted in kind of a huge shift in laws and programs and all these kinds of things. And so, but yeah, that chapter actually opens with this panel that I had attended that was really surprising to me. It was two women there to talk about female genital mutilation. And female genital mutilation, for those of you who don't know what it is, probably most of you do, kind of ranges from infibulation in Sudan and the surrounding areas, where they remove everything. They cut off all of a woman's external genitalia and then kind of suture the two sides shut except for a pinhole that she can urinate out of. And then the husband has to kind of basically tear her apart when they're married. And then it kind of diffuses as it goes south to just the removal of the external genitalia or just a clitoridectomy. And it's practiced in many countries in sub-Saharan Africa, and certainly not just among Muslims, although it has some Muslim connections in terms of its origin. But anyway, so I met this panel, and it was very rare to even see a debate about the practice. You know, usually you would just see a kind of debate about what's the best way to end it. But you have these two women sitting up on this stage in New York, and one of them is wearing traditional African robes and an African headdress and has this very thick Kenyan accent. And the other one is very sleek. She's wearing knee-high boots, a leather skirt, hair and ponytail, like incredibly modern looking. And she is the one who is defending the practice and who, in fact, is one of the kind of most high-profile defenders of the practice in the whole country. She comes from Sierra Leone. She's part of the Kono ethnic group, and they have a female secret society called Bundo, and this is part of the initiation into Bundo, and Bundo exercises a lot of power in Sierra Leone. And for her, getting this done was, she said, empowering. It connected her to her ancestors. It made her feel like there was some link between her and her kind of globalized existence and, you know, the village that her you know, grandmother and great-grandmother came from. And she argues that, you know, who are you in the West to demand that these women forsake a practice that they value deeply? And it really is true that in a lot of these countries, you know, if you took a vote, women would vote in places where it's practiced. Women, well, and everyone would vote overwhelmingly to keep it. I mean, people, it's important to them. They value it. And so I had to kind of weigh that and try to take that seriously and humanize it against the other evidence of both the damage that it does and the women who are kind of minority, you know, the women who are dissidents in their own societies, you know, who are fighting this practice or trying to escape from it, who I kind of ultimately concluded you know, just as oftentimes feminists in this country are kind of dissidents in our own societies, we have a kind of duty to show solidarity for women in other cultures who are also struggling against, you know, patriarchal norms and traditions and, you know, people who say that they're kind of undermining or subverting their culture by seeking freedom.
You know, that brings me to another time. In your book, you tell the story of a girl named Rosa, a Nicaraguan girl who at 9 years old became pregnant. And she was in Costa Rica. Her family was in Costa Rica picking coffee. And Costa Rica had a very strong anti-abortion policy. And her mother and stepfather wanted her to have an abortion. And this really united, feminists united behind her very strongly. And take the story.
Right. Yeah, it became a huge story in Nicaragua. Almost every country in Latin America, except for Cuba, has very strict abortion laws. And so when she became pregnant and the news, you know, hit the wires, there was a pregnant 9-year-old. And in certain ways, this recalls a really recent case. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, there was a case of a pregnant 9-year-old in Brazil. But anyways, the news hits the wires. And for the feminists in Nicaragua who've been trying to liberalize the abortion law there, this case seemed like a case that, you know, could galvanize people's attention and, you know, possibly precipitate change. Rosita, which is a pseudonym, it's a pseudonym that everybody used in the press down there and that everybody uses when talking about her, was, she said she had been raped. The guy who raped her, or who she accused of raping her, was arrested. And the feminists went to Costa Rica, feminists from Nicaragua went to Costa Rica. They hooked up with her parents. And although the Costa Rican government was saying, no, she can't have an abortion and we're not going to release her to her parents' custody, they eventually intervened. They got her released to a hotel. Then they smuggled her over the border into Nicaragua, where the whole drama, which was, you know, kind of getting more and more and more publicized, transfers to Nicaragua, where now the government, again, is saying, first we're going to appoint a panel. They're going back and forth about whether she can have the abortion. Meanwhile, you know, her pregnancy is advancing. These aren't the kind of things that you can dither about. Rose is in the hospital. They don't want to release her to her parents' custody. There's, you know, she's under surveillance. At one point, you know, hospitals were under, you know, orders not to let her go, and so eventually they put her in a wheelchair, and with her mother they run out the back door. And meanwhile, you have the Catholic Church and some kind of conservatives are saying that, you know, actually her stepfather was probably the one who raped her, and that's why they want this abortion, to kind of cover up the crime. And, you know, it's not uncommon in Latin America or anywhere, you know, to have stepfathers abusing their stepdaughters. But the feminists are saying, no, this is just this kind of slur against them because they're a poor family. And if you look at video footage, the parents seem very sympathetic, very sweet. Eventually, they smuggle the girl out of the hospital, but they can't bring her to any other hospital. The other hospitals are all under order to take her if she comes in. So they take her to a private house where three of the top gynecologists in Nicaragua perform the abortion. And when they announce it, public opinion is very much on the side of both the family and the feminists. And it so outraged the right that it was a big mobilizing factor in what happened in 2006, which was that Nicaragua banned all abortion, even if a woman's life is at stake, which means that you now have women, you know, hemorrhaging to death in hospitals, you know, going to hospitals with ectopic pregnancies and having to wait for their fallopian tubes to burst. So the new law is now being debated, and, you know, they're going to take it to the Supreme Court. It's getting international attention. The UN and donor countries are pressuring Nicaragua to change the law. And then Rosita shows up in the news again because her mother has called the police to accuse her stepfather of raping her. And it turns out that she got pregnant again shortly after the abortion. She has a 19-month-old child. It turns out it's an open secret in the neighborhood that the father was the stepfather. And suddenly the feminists are under this kind of cloud of complicity. I mean, they really didn't know, and they're really heartbroken about what happened, but there was also, I think, a bit of willful delusion in wanting to see the kind of perfect test case. And so, you know, although I certainly don't see that as an argument against the abortion, you know, a 9-year-old is certainly no more kind of prepared to give birth to a child because the father happens to be your stepfather. And I mean, in certain sense, it's even more of an argument for why this pregnancy shouldn't have gone to term, shouldn't have come to term. But I think in searching for the perfect test case, they missed an opportunity to rescue this girl from this really, really horrific situation. And of course, they've also damaged their standing and thus their cause, you know, kind of in Nicaraguan public opinion.
Well, one of the things that I really loved about your book was its willingness to grapple with nuance. That, you know, these aren't clean issues, and there's a lot of that, I think, in the book. Also, the sort of different coalitions that arise around different things, like the left and right, different religions. And the coalitions that are together on some things and apart on others, like that, you know, Catholics and conservative Protestants and Muslims are together on issues of abortion and premarital sex, but as you note in the book, there isn't a Muslim country that bans birth control.
Right.
So they're apart on certain other things. Another great story, I think, in the book is the Catholic Church's position on abortion and their sort of willingness to revisit that in the mid-60s and what happened with that.
Yeah, this is something, again, that I was so fascinated. You know, I kind of had heard about the Papal Commission on Birth Control, but, you know, digging into it was so interesting. You know, the 60s was a time, you know, besides the kind of ferment everybody knows, the 60s, you know, there was also Vatican II. There was, you know, this kind of sense of an opening up within the church, and there was also, of course, you know, this sudden global attention to population. And the Vatican was, you know, aware of all these international UN conferences. The Vatican is essentially a country for the purposes of the United Nations. It has, you know, diplomatic representation, and it's not sure how it should kind of navigate this new situation, and so. Pope John established something called the Papal Commission on Birth Control to investigate the church's position. The position was already starting to change because even the rhythm method was a relatively recent kind of innovation in terms of it being allowed. And so since the rhythm method seemed to sanction, you know, sex that's not for procreation, it seemed to a lot of people like the next step was going to be some shift. And what's crazy too is that people actually, you know, John Rock, who was one of the people who developed, who was a Catholic doctor, was one of the people who developed the birth control pill. People thought the birth control pill was going to be more acceptable to the Catholic Church because it seemed to mimic a woman's natural cycle, and the church was already okay with kind of using a woman's natural cycle in this way. So they established this commission. The commission collects hundreds of interviews of couples who are talking about what a negative thing rhythm has been in their life, either because it's not working or because it means that women are constantly, you know, denying sex to their husbands. It's creating all this tension. People say that they've tried to be faithful, but that it's, you know, it's kind of harming their marriages a lot, you know, and then at the same time, there's, you know, growing concern for overpopulation. And so eventually, the members of this commission recommend, and the commission grows over time. This whole thing kind of is drawn out. But eventually, they recommend a revision in the church's teaching on birth control, you know, and they recommend that it be permitted within married couples. And what happens is that there's this panic in the upper, you know, in the upper levels of the Vatican about what this would mean for kind of papal authority. You know, if you admit that the church has been wrong all these years, then what are you saying about, you know, kind of the infallibility of the church? And there's one of the lines that I love is this Vatican official who says, well, what of all the people that we've sent to hell under the old teaching?
Right.
You know, and so they eventually, you know, conclude that for, you know, in order to kind of maintain the clear authority of the church, they need to maintain this prohibition, which is, to me, just such kind of fascinating evidence of how arbitrary it is.
I also thought it was really interesting that there was concern that the Episcopalians allowed birth control. And so this made the Catholic Church have to say that the Episcopalians had been right all
along. They said, you know, are we going to admit that the Holy Spirit had been at the Lambeth Convention?
So the final thing that we'll talk about, and then we'll open up for questions, is you talk a lot about overpopulation, but I think that you say in the book that you came at underpopulation with a more skeptical attitude, the whole idea that in European countries particularly, underpopulation is becoming as big a problem in its own way as overpopulation is in some parts of the world.
Yeah, and it's such a tricky thing to talk about because, you know, if you start saying, well, there's too many people in Africa and too few in Europe, you know, you're going down a really treacherous road. And also, you know, this was something that was of such great concern on the right. You hear so much talk about the right, about, you know, Europe's demographic suicide, Europe's demographic winter, a real panic that they're not...
This is what happens when feminists...
Right, exactly. Feminism presages the death of the West. That's, you know, one of their favorite lines. And that, you know, and there's whole conferences. You know, you spoke before about kind of these alliances between, you know, Catholics and evangelicals and Muslims. That's not just the kind of theoretical alliance. I mean, there's actually meetings, you know, big international meetings, you know, like with names like the World Congress of Families. And they're talking about, you know, this kind of terror of our women, you know, of being outbred, although they don't necessarily agree on this point because the Christians are really worried that the Muslims are outbreeding them. But so anyway, so I approached this very skeptically, thinking that this was just kind of, you know, both like a race and a gender panic. But the more I talked to demographers and people who study social policy, this is going to be a big problem in a lot of places. You know, not everywhere, but if you have, you know, birth rates of like 1.3, 1.2, 1.4 children per woman, it's going to be very, very hard to maintain pension systems, to maintain, you know, all the kind of things that we love about, or that I love about, you know, kind of the European social system. And the obvious answer is immigration. But, you know, there's kind of the unfortunate fact that there's a limit to how many people a country can absorb without kind of provoking a real nationalist backlash. So, you know, one of the numbers I have is that if Italy's birth rate from 1995 remained consistent over 100 years, the population 100 years hence would be 14% of what it is today. You know, so Italy is not going to... It's going to have to learn to accept more immigrants, but it's going to be a very rocky thing to replace all those people with immigrants. There's like something to be said for higher birth rates. But what you see that is so fascinating to me and kind of so heartening to me is that it's not every European country that has this problem. This problem is very specific to countries that have maintained, that have modernized in certain ways, modernized economically and industrially, but that have maintained kind of patriarchal social structures, you know, conservative religion, et cetera. And so when you have a country where women want to work and have the opportunity to work, but don't have the social supports, you know, daycare, supportive husbands, you know, family leave, all these different things, they're not having children. The birth rates in France, in Sweden, in Norway, in Denmark are fine. You know, they're slightly below replacement, but in a way that's totally manageable. You know, and like, you know, we're talking 1.9, 1.2 children per woman. So essentially there is, you know, and this is kind of really well known in the social science literature, but I felt like hadn't made it at all down into the level of public conversation that, you know, after a certain level of development, you know, kind of patriarchy contributes to dangerously low birth rates, and which leads to what I thought was an even more kind of pleasing symmetry, which is that it turns out that women's rights and, you know, increased attention to women's needs are the answer to both overpopulation and to kind of depopulation.
It's a happy ending. And the one last thing that I just remembered, there was a saying, you said something in your book that I'd love to have you just talk about for a couple of minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions. You say, save for a few corners of Scandinavia, there is no country on earth that doesn't discriminate against women. And what do you mean by that?
Well, I guess that, you know, I think that feminists used to want to believe that there was some kind of prelapsarian culture that, you know, some kind of prelapsarian matriarchy in which women reign supreme and that, you know, it's only kind of the modern industrial West. But in fact, that's not, there is, you know, there's, if that exists, it's very much lost in the mists of time. You know, kind of discrimination against women and gender hierarchies are pretty universal. And that can be a kind of a somewhat disturbing thing to face because it can make it seem natural. You know, and people tend to associate natural with right. And I'm making two arguments here. I'm saying, first of all, it's natural the way that violence is natural or the way that violence is universal. And violence is universal, but it's not universally common. You know, you have certain societies that are very violent and certain societies that are not very violent. And there's choices you can make about how to arrange a society to, you know, to kind of change those outcomes. But then more than that, it's not, you know, you see kind of over and over again, whether you're talking about these distorted sex ratios in Asia or you're talking about overpopulation or you're talking about, you know, kind of depopulation in Europe, is that the, you know, kind of patriarchy is, it has become maladaptive. And I think that didn't used to be the case. You know, it used to be that in kind of agrarian societies, there was a certain Darwinian sense to these kind of arrangements, right? Your wealth and your power comes from your ability to tame the land, to work the land. More children are an economic asset. The man who can control the most women and, you know, have the most children has the greatest wealth. And that is different now. You know, 2008, which was another pleasing symmetry, you know, 2008, the year I finished this book, was this tipping point in kind of world history. It was the year that more than half the people on Earth lived in cities. And so, you know, in the urban future, it just doesn't work anymore. And, you know, which is the kind of heart of the argument of my book, is that issues of kind of women's rights and women's empowerment and women's reproductive freedom, which are always shoved to the side and treated as these kind of trivial adjuncts to the really important issues of, you know, war and peace and poverty and development, but in fact, that women's rights are really at the center.
Great. So I'm sure that you have questions. Who wants to go first? Yes. Can you hold on 1 second for the microphone?
I'm just kind of stunned a little bit because there was so much information and very interesting anecdotes and actual lives portrayed to support your argument. But I'm just wondering, why should there always be a fight between men and women? Aren't they supposed to be doing things hand in hand? And, you know, there's not a question of who's going to be at the center, but there's not really a question of who is going to be at the center, but what should be the center and how they should revolve around that center?
There certainly doesn't always have to be a fight between men and women. And, you know, in kind of, you know, in an ideal world, there wouldn't be. But the fact is that they're often, you know, kind of resources and power are often kind of, you know, limited commodities, and more for one person sometimes necessarily does mean less for another. And, you know, when men have had a certain amount of control over women's bodies and women's lives and women's reproduction, and being asked to give that up, they're losing something, you know, and nobody wants to lose power. Nobody wants to give up, you know, privileges and prerogatives that they've enjoyed since time immemorial and that they think are their right and that they believe are God-given. And also because women's advancement is so tied up with globalization and modernization and all the urbanization and all these things that have people feeling totally discombobulated and, you know, kind of adrift and emasculated, it's very tempting to think that if you can just put women back in their place, everything else will somehow fall into place. I think that's why every fundamentalist movement almost in the world targets women. And then the final thing I would say is that, you know, the old economic models about how wealth was used within families always treated the married couple or the family as a unit and assumed that there was this kind of egalitarian distribution of resources within families. And then research that was done in later years showed that if you look very closely at kind of who, when there's limited food and when there's limited resources and limited access to medical care, who gets what within a family is very much determined in many countries by who earns what. And so it turns out that when women work outside the home, they actually are, they have a greater claim on the family's resources. And when they have a greater claim on the family's resources, their children have tend to do better. It's a sad but true fact that in some countries they've done these expenditure surveys. And when you raise a man's income, you raise his standard of living. You know, he'll go out, not all men by any means, but just in terms of kind of what economists have found. He'll go out and buy himself some new clothes, you know, take himself out to the bar, you know, buy himself perhaps a new radio. And, you know, when you raise a woman's income, she will make sure her kids go to the doctors, enroll them in school, buy them clothes. She's just much more likely to invest in her children. And, you know, whether or not that seems, you know, kind of like a fair or, you know, just description is almost kind of beside the point. I mean, that's, you know, kind of become the consensus view about what's actually happening.
So how about, well, I don't, you can just hand it away.
In Pakistan, I saw a video 2 weeks ago about a woman being held down by her brother, based on at least the story that I read, an allegation of not even a courtroom or just an allegation that she might have done something inappropriate. And she endured 37 lashes from a priest or something. To our cultural box, that's, you know, pretty appalling, but how did that situation play to the home crowd in Pakistan? I mean, how do the people that live there feel about that?
I mean, I wouldn't presume to, you know, to speak for the people of Pakistan or to say that, you know, I'm an expert on Pakistani mores. What I do understand is that, you know, I think that this was in the Swat Valley, is that the Swat Valley was not historically a incredibly rigid kind of Taliban-esque place. So it's not true that this is just kind of Pakistani culture and that it's, you know, not up to us to question, you know, the way that they're living. In fact, this is something that's been imposed on them from without relatively recently, you know, and that has people in a state of terror. I mean, certainly there are people who support it, but I don't think it's something that is, you know, something of Pakistan, you know, something that's kind of popular in Pakistan. But I think it also raises to me what is a really interesting question, which is what do we do about that? Because on the one hand, you have an administration that has committed itself to a more humble, realist foreign policy in which we're going to negotiate with the Taliban and we're not going to try to, you know, create revolutionary changes within these societies. And there's a lot to be said for a more humble, realist foreign policy, but it contradicts with another aim of our, or another stated aim of our foreign policy, which is women's rights. And I actually do think that ultimately it's always tempting to jettison women's rights when there's other priorities like national security and stuff, but ultimately it ends up being really counterproductive.
Hi, well, first of all, thanks for coming out tonight and speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Well, the first question, quick question, because I haven't actually read your book yet, but I was wondering if you've read Everything Conceivable by the Washington Post writer.
Anyway, it sounds like I should.
I was just wondering what you thought. Now, this, you didn't really touch on this during your talk, but my question pertains to embryonic stem cell research. And I wondered if maybe this was an area that you did delve into research-wise? Because my question is that, you know, recently the federal funding, the ban on federal funding, of course, was overturned. And I wonder what your thoughts were on that, given that stem cell research can perfectly take place without using embryos, as has been demonstrated by Carnegie Mellon University and lots of research universities.
This isn't, I don't look at stem cell research. I mean, that's kind of outside the purview of my book. But I would say that almost everything that I have read has shown that there's potential, right, to use other kinds of stem cells, but that as far as I know, and I'm not an expert, they're still, I don't think that they've proven irrevocably that, or that they've proven absolutely that that there's no need, or that there's, you know, that you can do everything with other kinds of stem cells that, that you can do with embryonic stem cells.
The other thing I think that in your book you come back to again and again and again is that women controlling their reproductive rights is what's crucial here, and that, you know, that extends kind of to just about everything, probably including whether a fetus is used for research or not.
Well, I mean, the strange thing to me about the embryonic stem cell debate is that it's not really a matter of creating fetuses, and it's not even a matter of discarding fetuses. I mean, there's very few people that I've heard of. I mean, the Catholic Church actually has a kind of admirable consistency on this in that they oppose IVF and they oppose stem cell research. But that's not really in the political debate. You don't really hear people who oppose stem cell research opposing the IVF treatments that are creating this kind of massive backlog of embryos that are just kind of in this storage limbo and are certainly never going to be used.
Thank you very much for your comments. And back to the Catholic Church for a moment. I wanted to ask whether you were aware of there's a movement to try to get the Vatican out of the UN as well, because they've been so damaging in their lobbying to prevent women's rights from being respected, women's reproductive rights. But it was no mere accident that they were recognized by the UN as a state, and they're hardly that, and I say that speaking as a Catholic. But my other comment was about whether you have detected any backlash after having imported so many Chinese girls to this country and to Canada, now that there's a recognized lack of partners for the men. Have you heard any discussion about that? And do you? And also, could you touch on the issue? I know there's no correlation between adoption and abortion rates, but there is a kind of funny phenomenon that's going now that with the rise in these international adoptions, we see that perhaps in the developing world, there's some relationship between the countries that don't allow adoption and why suddenly they have surplus babies as well. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I'm aware of the campaign, and Frances Kissling, who's a woman I admire tremendously, who's the founder of Catholics for a Free Choice, was very involved in the campaign to strip the Holy See of its place at the United Nations. As for a question about a backlash about kind of sending baby girls to the United States, if there is one, I'm not aware of it. And again, it's because it's kind of a tragedy of the commons issue. You know, people might think that it's important in the abstract to have more girls, but that doesn't mean that they personally are willing to raise them, and, you know, certainly not when they're kind of going to be using up their quota. And so, yeah, I'm not aware of, you know, any kind of sense of, like, no, we have to keep, although it could be there, but if it is, I'm not aware of it, any sense, you know, that we have to kind of keep our daughters at home. And as for the international adoption thing, my friend E.J. Graff, who's an investigative journalist, did a piece, or she did a huge research project, actually, about this, and there was a piece, I believe, in Foreign Affairs and in a number of other places about, you know, the kind of vogue for foreign adoptions and the sense among the West that there's just all these babies out there waiting to be taken, that they kind of have no histories and no families and that they're just waiting for us. And it turns out that there is actually much less of a surplus, of kind of orphans or unwanted children than you might imagine. But as with anything, once a market develops, for babies, you know, kind of things, you know, various mechanisms arise to serve that market. And so I'm actually not sure what the correlation between that and abortion is. I'm sure that actually that there are places where women are aware that they can sell their unwanted children, you know, and you know, babies are being sold all over the world, although it seems to be kind of traffickers and brokers and things that are making the money off that rather than mothers. And I kind of doubt that poor women are that aware of these channels or these opportunities existing, certainly not enough to kind of really impact abortion rates. But I would be almost certain that in certain places that's, you know, a consideration for a woman in that circumstance.
Michelle, thank you also for this discussion and the two of you for this. It's really marvelous to see these issues kind of brought down into the realm of story, and your grasp of the, you know, the statistics and research is so impressive. I'm really struck both by your passion and your lack of sentimentality in talking about these issues, and I wish you would talk a little bit, tell us a little about your repertorial process and how you find some of these specific stories and how your own emotional response to them, how do you deal with it? Because some of them are really tough stories.
You know, in a certain way, it was funny. When I've talked about this book sometimes with people who have kind of a more like formal academic background, people have asked me, you know, what's your methodology? And I kind of have been glad that I'm a reporter and I don't have to have one. I mean, honestly, like, this sounds, in as much as I have kind of a repertorial, you know, as much as I have, like, a process, it's kind of to show up and see what you can find, you know? So, you know, when I had the huge luxury with this book of being able to, you know, fly to a country for 6 weeks or so with just, like, a couple of contacts and, you know, you figure out who are the main spokespeople and you work out from there, you know, who should I talk to next? I mean, in Nicaragua, the Rosita case was inescapable. I mean, it was actually the one thing that both sides agreed on. You know, if you talk to the anti-abortion forces and you talk to the feminists about what precipitated this law, both of them will say it was the Rosita case. You know, so it was kind of obvious that that should be there. Other places, you know, kind of one of the dirty little secrets of journalists who work in foreign countries is the huge amount of help you can get from fixers, you know, so who are really kind of your co-reporters, even though you end up getting the credit. So in India, I put out word on the South Asian journalist listserv that I needed a translator and a fixer. And I ended up working with this guy named Aziz, who was, you know, every bit the reporter that I am, if not more. And, you know, besides just kind of, you know, scheduling things for me or talking to the police when it was, you know, they weren't necessarily going to want to talk to a foreign woman or translating for me, he also just had his ear to the ground a lot of cases. He was actually the person who introduced me to Sunita and Kajal and the story of that shelter in Ahmedabad.
Hi. I was wondering if you could touch on three things. Infant mortality rates and the idea of that and where women fall in that, looking at, you know, demographic pyramids of these kind of places where they are having so many extra babies, but there is a very large infant mortality rate, life expectancy, and what you found in terms of that, especially in the European countries where they're not having that many children. And then what about sexually transmitted diseases? So in places like Thailand where they have contraceptive programs with condoms and those kind of things where women are and are not able to make the choice to have children, a lot of that has to do with the spread of HIV and AIDS and drug trade and those kind of things and where that falls in the sense of feminist theory about reproduction and those types of things.
Okay. What was the first one again?
The weighty issue.
The first one was...
Oh, you were talking... You asked about infant mortality. And basically, yeah, high infant mortality is a primary reason for high birth rates, you know, throughout history, is that, you know, women who wanted to have two or three children had to have six or seven, if not more, because, you know, you could not count on your children surviving into adulthood. And one of the reasons that the population boom happened, the, you know, the explosion that freaked people out so much in the 50s and 60s, is that there was huge advances in public health after World War II, which brought down mortality somewhat without bringing down, you know, without a kind of corresponding drop in birth rates. I mean, things that, you know, people don't change their behavior that fast. And still throughout, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, throughout much of India, child mortality is still so much higher than it needs to be. And that's really a case where women's education, women's rights and women's education, although you wouldn't necessarily think of that as the most important factor, most of the research about it shows that it is. You know, it turns out that women's education has a more profound impact on kind of the child mortality than almost any other independent variable. And it's not just the research that I've read says it's not just because about they're learning about health or, you know, they're kind of better, you know, they're better able to, you know, dismiss, you know, kind of traditional practices or whatever. It also has to do with, one, resources, the ability to kind of demand resources within the family to take a kid to the doctor, especially a girl. And two, kind of confidence. You know, there was one person who said that a woman who's not educated will be more afraid to go to a doctor and say that his prescription wasn't working because she doesn't want to, she doesn't know how to tell a powerful man that he failed. And so, so that's a kind of hugely, hugely important factor. And it has, it's this kind of either vicious or virtuous cycle, because a woman who is more educated, who has lower child mortality, can have fewer children and be more confident of their survival, you know, which leads to children who are better educated, who have fewer children, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the kind of the reverse happens when women are, you know, have no options but to have very, very large families. The part about, well, let me start with Thailand. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's as in many cases with kind of public health and contraceptive and family planning programs, they often kind of get the biggest impetus when there's something besides women's lives or women's health at stake. You know, when it's about a pandemic or when it's about national security or when it's about, you know, food security or all these kind of things, then somehow the international system gets in gear in a way that it can't, in a way that it just seems kind of unable to do so when it's just women. But I would say that it's not just the AIDS pandemic that's made Thailand so responsive. You know, most of the countries of East Asia took really profound steps to address what they saw as the problem of overpopulation. And what's interesting is that there's some Harvard economists that I quote in this book who estimate that 30% of East Asia's kind of economic growth during the years when, you know, everyone was talking about the Asian tigers is attributable to this demographic change. And that, you know, the only country that didn't have that kind of economic growth, of course, in that region is the Philippines, where they didn't adopt these policies. And STDs, one of the things that when feminists started taking over the what had been the population infrastructure and started saying that, no, you have to talk about women's health holistically and women's reproductive health, and it's not just about making women not have more babies, you know, and it's not just, you can't just talk about women in these abstract terms. Part of that was that, yeah, there wasn't the attempt, you know, you would have this kind of brand new equipment and, you know, everything would be, you know, all the resources you needed to get a woman to stop having children and very little to treat, you know, epidemics of STDs, which also cause, you know, huge amounts of, I mean, besides just human suffering, huge amounts of infertility, which is devastating. I mean, as devastating as infertility is in many countries, it's, you know, exponentially more so in places where a woman's whole identity and whole kind of reason for being is bound up with childbearing. So that was, I think, one of the most positive things to come out of, again, this was an infrastructure that was started for reasons of national security and for these kind of reasons of real politic, but has shifted over time because of the work of some really heroic women to be, to address STDs and to address, you know, the kind of whole range of factors that are, you know, shape women's sexual lives.
Thank you. I look forward to reading the book. I'm curious to know, what was the audience you had in mind when you were writing? Are you aiming primarily for an American audience, or would you prefer aiming more toward an international audience? And the reason I ask that is I'm curious to know to what degree you think changes in American policy could improve women's reproductive rights worldwide.
Let me answer your second question first, and to say that I think that changes in American policy have an absolutely profound effect on women's reproductive rights worldwide. In fact, changes in American administrations tend to have a greater impact on women's reproductive rights around the world than they do here at home, because I mean, we're protected to some extent by Roe versus Wade, as well as things like the First Amendment, which doesn't apply, which people around the world don't have, which means that the United States can attach policies like the global gag rule and say that, healthcare providers can't even talk about abortion, can't, agitate for abortion law reform, even in countries where unsafe abortion is a huge cause of maternal mortality. So yes, I mean, the kind of vicissitudes of American policy, it has this huge and immediate life or death effect around the world that people here are barely even aware of. And so when you ask who's the audience, I would say, obviously, do I, like any author, I hope that the book gets translated, and I hope,
every village in all of Africa, all of Latin America.
But it's definitely written, with an American audience in mind, and although it's not primarily reported on American soil, it's often about the repercussions of American policy. And I think it's important for people to know, one, because again, it has such a huge effect, because the extent to which kind of American women can get their government to take women's issues seriously is an issue of kind of profound consequence for the entire planet. And also because I feel like American feminism and the way it's covered is so often tied up in trivialities and shopping and Sex in the City and mommy wars and all these kinds of things. American feminism, the way it's talked about, and I don't really blame women's activists for this, it seems like this very, again, kind of trivial and silly, symbolic kind of thing. And in fact, nothing is more important, than feminism. And so I see it as being as horrible as many of these stories are, and as kind of wrenching, and as painful as it sometimes is to contemplate that, it's also, I think, inspiring for a political movement to know that so much, kind of rides on its success.
I want to thank you all for coming tonight and remind you that, wait, that you will have an opportunity to empty your wallets, your purses.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.